of the secular art of life. These aristocracies were for the most part nominally Catholic, and many of them produced a great treasure, benefit, and glory for the church. But these families, growing into power, also held certain rights apart from the church, and the privileges of these rights became more and more sedulously protected. The individual was determined to preserve such freedoms and opportunities and rights as were his own. Also, the power of the church in the lower courts came to be questioned, and law and theology began to give way to law and equity. And we find the criminal no longer judged by God, but judged by a jury of his peers, a jury selected of others like himself, man passing upon man and his conduct, not God arbitrarily declaring justice and injustice. All these patterns now, as I think you will see, made a rather strenuous century. And we must begin to conceive now of what these patterns led to, how they affected the reintegration of European consciousness. The first thing they all contributed to, more or less, was enlightenment, education, advancement. The European mind suddenly realized that in its weakness it could never be victorious in anything. The king began to realize that a stupid peasantry was no shining jewel in his crown, that there was no credit, prestige, or honor in ruling the mindless. It was also recognized that in an emergency, when need arose, it was rather important that someone could think, and that in all situations requiring leadership, in the development of nations and of states, the need for the statesman appeared, the need for the scholar, the need for the educator, even the need for the beginnings of a scientific pursuit, and also the need of the voyager, the navigator, the traveler, the adventurer. And most of these needs had to spring from a sense of emancipation within the soul. A man had to have courage to go into distant places. He had to have enthusiasm to advance his way of life. He had to put his own soul into the things he was doing. And to do this, he must know what he is doing. And he must have something to do that captured not only his labor, but his imagination. Europe was coming out of a kind of coma, and man was reaching around to find purposes for his own existence. He found some of these purposes in the defense of his faith, as in the Crusades, in which, although he was not really defending because he was in an offensive position, still he believed he was defending. He believed that he was making the greatest possible sacrifice for the greatest possible good that he could conceive. But out of the Crusades, something else was happening that was to affect the whole situation also. During the Crusades, we have the most polyglot administration of situations recorded in history. And from the ample perspective of his great divan in Baghdad, Saladin made a very astute remark, namely, that the European or Christian crusaders were not defeated by the Saracen alone. They were defeated by the confusion of unleadered mobs. The complete lack of understanding, of leadership, and mostly of cooperation. All these little individuals carrying their feuds to the walls of Jerusalem and killing each other before the Saracens could shoot them down with their bows and arrows. This was one of the tragedies of the Crusades, and this is one of the reasons why the Arabs, though technically in many cases in an inferior position, were able to win. First, they had a cause. They were protecting their own land. Secondly, they had a conviction, their religion, which was strong within them and which bound them not only to the faith but to the protection of its sacred places. And even more than this, they had 500 years of education by which they had learned to work together and had buried their own feuds. They had been fortunate, of course, in having a leader that they commonly respected in Saladin. Europe had no such leader that it commonly respected. So we see for 200 years nearly the manpower of Europe drawn off into the Crusades. With this manpower, because of the nature of it, went not only the yeomanry, the serfs, bondsmen who worked upon the lands of the lords and barons and counts and dukes and princes and whatnots, but also the aristocrats themselves. At the head of each of these little processions of soldiers going forth to holy war was a group of caparison knights upon their prancing horses. These knights were the gentry. They led the others. And as a result of that, the entire feudal system of Europe went out to die. Many of them, most of them, either did not come back or returned too late. Wars in those days were not fought in years or 10-year periods. Many of these men who went out to fight in the Crusades did not return, not because they were killed, but because they died of old age before they could get back. It was a situation in which there were ulterior motives lurking behind all of this problem. One of these ulterior motives was revealed by the remarks of Saladin. When all this gentry arrived at Acre and other centers along the Muslim front, these gentries were not on speaking terms. In fact, most of them hardly understood each other's languages. Each one wished to lead everything. Each one, by some right or reason, had peculiar privileges that came before every other consideration. And so they haggled, and they argued, and they feuded, and they rattled and clanked their armors. But they came to no united front. This means that back home, where they came from, they had never had a united front either. They had lived in their little castles on the hills, defending themselves against intruders, living a kind of gentle, roisterous existence, with little thought for anything except their own comfort and security. There was no concept of a general government, and the only over-government that existed was the church. And this government rested rather lightly even then upon those in privileged positions. Outside of the great incentives to save holy places, there seems to have been a well-worked-out subterfuge, namely, the growing power of certain families, certain groups. These groups have begun to sense within themselves what we might term nationalism. They were aware that these scattered feudal districts could be bound into great states, and that over these great states, still greater princes might arise. And while the Crusaders were out on their mission of salvation, these large families and special groups moved in behind them in Europe and broke the feudal system completely apart. When these who did return got home, they found their small rights swallowed up in the greater privileges of the strong. And in this transition, we see the rise of the first great national entities of Europe. We find the beginnings, not the full forms, but the beginnings of what were to be France and Germany and Italy. We find the various factors at work that were to bind together cities and states, and to lift dukes and counts and princes to the final estate of empiric lines. Naming the world, of course, was difficult. But even this had its part to play, because in nationalism, you had a larger family pattern, a tremendous amount of energy that had previously been wasted in remaining apart was now available for common labor and common effort. This led, of course, to both positive and negative results. The rise of these larger national blocks made possible a more advanced method of life for many people. It gave them freedom from the constant pillaging of their neighbors. It made possible their retaining their lands more safely, and the possibility of living a full life on the earth without being taken away to war began to grow bright for many. On the other hand, these combinations resulted in larger individual political units, with the result that major wars could come into existence, which had previously been almost impossible. The only other way that you could have had major wars was probably like the Crusades, a group of nations uniting on an objective. But now, comparatively large groups with powerful resources could be locked in wars for 10, 20, 50, or 100 years due to the slow movement of military machinery and military tactic at that time. So these became both curse and blessing. The walled city came to be of very little value, and most of the value that remained disappeared with another development which rose largely again in this critical period and was imported from Asia. And this was the so-called discovery of gunpowder. Now, gunpowder has had many uses, but one that we seldom realize or think too much about has been its psychological effect on the equality of man. Gunpowder ended, for example, the age of chivalry. It ended the knight in armor riding at the head of his group, fairly well protected behind a reasonable fortification of boiler iron, and almost invulnerable. It also ended the walled city and the protection of the high wall against which the primitive engines of battering rams and so forth took a very difficult and lengthy time to make impression. Gunpowder made the humblest yeoman, the poorest soldier in the army, the one who might be responsible for the death of the king. This was psychologically very important and reformed entirely military tactics, with the leaders moving to the back rather than riding out in front. The fancy for riding out in front took a serious reverse. Gunpowder not only did this important thing, but it began to create vast uneasiness among the great. It became more and more obvious that the power of privileged groups to utterly and completely control peoples was fast disappearing. Prior to that time, with luck, the despot might have a comparatively smooth time. But with these changes, despotism became ever more hazardous, ever more difficult to maintain, and allegiances shifted their patterns. Just as the church had been forced to a new position by the Magna Carta, so the principalities and dukedoms of Europe and their rulers were forced to a new position by the advent of gunpowder. It became no longer possible to control by force alone. The reign of force, the power of physical persuasion, the fear of physical retaliation, these began to lose their general effectiveness. And we find a very important psychological change coming, and that was the rise of government by persuasion. By winning the confidence of peoples, by attempting to create some closer affinity, new focal points, placing a censorship upon the luxury of princes, making it ever increasingly dangerous for the prince to lose the confidence of his people. The final and terrible example of this probably, of course, came much later, in the French Revolution. But the seeds of the French Revolution were sowed at the time of the Crusades for a new pattern, a new way of life was distinctly on the rise. And against this motion, no one could exercise a truly restraining power. So for a moment, to summarize our Phoenix cycle pattern, we see how the period from 6 to 1200 resulted in the gradual falling apart of a world that had received a powerful impulse at the time of the rise of Islam. Islam, in the 600 years that followed its rise, integrated its own position, tied itself closely into the Eastern way of life, and came finally to such a powerful unity that it was tempted to attack Western civilization. During these 600 years, Western civilization had been more or less in a doldrum. The thing that really saved it more than anything else was its so-called barbarian fringe. During the collapse of the Roman Empire and during the decadence of the Dark Ages, a great number of peoples had remained essentially untouched. Culture and civilization had moved around Byzantium and the Roman center in Italy. The outskirts, the far-flung fragments of the old Roman colonial empire, had remained a pretty stout group. They had, of course, received Christianity and had from this circumstance added one important uniting factor. But when the East moved in upon the West, it could not move in upon Florence, or upon Rome, or upon London. It had to move in through the Balkans, and back in the area of South Russia. And in so doing, it ran against the newly converted Christian people, themselves still in a highly integrated state of vigorous barbarism. These people, however, were converted to the Western way of life and became its great exponents, its great protectors. And because these people were still vigorous, and also because the Mongol Empire had overreached its reasonable boundaries, Genghis Khan had been forced to spread his armies too thin to control all of Asia. Also, he was near the end of his own life. And in all these strategic circumstances, the final wave that struck Europe was not the full impact of the great Mongol horde. Had it been, it probably would have carried everything before it. It was reduced by long separation from its source of supplies. It was reduced also by the same thing that Europe suffered, namely so many wars over so long a period of time that generations of men were exhausted. Due to these circumstances, perhaps historically, we find that the Muslim world did not at that time succeed in conquering all of Europe. Also, there were dissensions between the Mongols and the Arabs. There were numerous feuds in various parts of the world that still occupied some attention. Altogether, Western Europe was spared. But Western Europe had seen the handwriting on the wall. Western Europe realized that it could no longer drift along in illiteracy and ignorance. It could no longer live upon the simple sophistry that it was the only existing culture. It could no longer assume that only Europe was important. And this was the challenge that we refer to today as the challenge of healthy competition. Europe suddenly became aware that other people would do something with Europe if the Europeans did not. This was a challenge. It opened the way to Europe be preparing to defend itself and its boundaries and to defend its own orders rather than to assume that no one else was of importance. Meeting this challenge of a rising Islamic power and a tremendous unfoldment of strength in Asia, Europe by necessity united, brought its various elements into the best patterns possible, and began to think in terms of strong alliances, a strong federation of powers. Now against this, of course, you had reactionaries. You have the cry of the church against the rights of man. You have the still continuing tendency of all nobility to exploit peoples. But we also have the emergence of something else, which education always brings. Education inevitably causes the individual to pause. It causes him to reflect a little. And it attacked one of the great problems of European life and attacked it firmly. And that is the problem of the individual having no social consciousness, total social unadjustment. It began to be rather obvious with the breaking up of the feudal system and the arising of the embryos of nationalism that there were allegiances necessary. It was difficult indeed for the yeoman and the serf and the fief to find very much of glamour in the feudal lord who ruled him. He was very close to this man. He saw just exactly how uncouth he was, how he wasted and squandered his means, and how he practically spent his life in debauchery and conspiracy. It was not easy to have any great affection for such a person, and religion supplied the link by which the serf was morally obligated to serve his lord. Of course, there was also the problem of land and tenancy and the need of some way to make a living. But the inducements were not good, not essentially sound. But with the coming of nationalism, there came a new inducement to each citizen. Namely, that the state must be strong. That the citizen owed not only a duty to himself, but to the collective body of which he was a part. It became essential for him to recognize that he depended upon the state for his own survival. He had learned some of these principles from feudalism, but they were brought home to him in a larger pattern. Also, most of the citizens of a state were somewhat further removed from their leaders. States composed of many communities. The leader was more grand, more glorious, and less available. These were important considerations because men with imagination build virtues where they do not exist. And the brilliant leader over a large group with a splendid entourage began to be impressive and to gain the respect and admiration and awe and veneration of these peoples. So the leader became more or less the symbol of the state. And devotion to the leader was devotion to the state, and vice versa. Thus, the preservation of the state began to involve many things previously never thought of. One was the common distribution of food. Under the feudal system, if the feudal lord was a man of some integrity, he held certain stores which were available to his tenants in time of famine. Under the state system, various taxes and means were devised by means of which available goods in emergency were procurable. The need to maintain these supplies, the need to preserve the treasury, the need to maintain an army, these things came home directly to the individual. He was not maintaining an army for another, for a prince or a feudal despot, but for his own family, for his neighbors, for the people down the street, for the men he worked with. They now had a common share in the political situation. And as a little more education added to this pattern, we gradually begin to see the rudiments of a humanistic basis of relations and values. The rise of humanism follows very closely upon this situation. But our whole period of 600 years with which we are concerned leads approximately from the period 1200 to about the year 1800. Now, the early parts of this period represent the building up of a system of life built upon Aquinas and the Magna Carta. And as in case of the previous cycles, it opened comparatively well. It opened with a lot of suffering, yes, but with a lot of momentum, a lot of dynamic, and a tremendous capacity to change things. Then, having attained to a certain degree, it likewise began to fall away. In this case, the falling away was a little different from the situations that had previously existed. We are reminded a little bit, perhaps, of our present economic situation, where it seems, perhaps, to many persons that we are on the verge of falling away into a recession. Just when it looks as though a recession might even lead to a depression, we suddenly find an important change in policy of government. We find the emergency created by the advancement of electronics and the launching of the satellites suddenly seems to change everything. Whether this change will be more than temporary, we cannot say, but it brings in an unexpected factor, cutting through things. Now, the decline of Europe and its destiny between the 12th and the 18th century was made eccentric by a series of these unexpected factors, factors which could have been prophesied as calculated risks, but the actual impact of these did not exactly meet the expectancy. The motion from the 12th century through the 13th and toward the 14th, this tremendous motion resulting from the period of the post-Crusades, the rise of Thomism, the motion of the Eastern culture into Europe, first by way of Byzantium, the returning Crusaders, and then upward from Southern Europe, from Italy, from the Republic of Venice, from the great mercantile centers there, from the commerce of the Adriatic and of the Eastern Mediterranean and even North Africa, it moved into Europe and moved up through Europe into Rome, Florence, and finally into Germany and France. And this great cultural motion, which culminated in the most brilliant period in European medievalism, we know as the Renaissance. The Renaissance, therefore, was the golden age of the consequences of the Magna Carta and of Aquinas. The roots that were laid at that time, the roots of a larger, broader, and deeper relationship of things, the growing world of learning, the world of letters, the patronage of arts, the rise of great families, wealthed in many cases by the traffic with the East, the splendid concept of a wider world, the restoration of ancient arts, the effort to restore Greek philosophy, the effort to restore culture, tremendous things such as the great Florentine Academy of Lorenzo de' Medici. Now everybody wanted to learn. Everyone wanted to know. Nearly 700 years of waiting to find out had created a pressure. And into this pressure men moved, resolute in their determination to know. As one historian says, they wanted to know so badly that they found out a great many things that were not so. They were moving tremendously, however, under the pressure of this situation. Now also, in spite of the fact that Aquinas had moved well within the order of sanctity, and that the wounds of the Magna Carta had more or less healed over, if not underneath, the streams of situation were also flowing from the Magna Carta and from Aquinas, and were moving inevitably towards another tremendous eccentric that was thrown into the situation at this time, and that was the Protestant Reformation. The Protestant Reformation was nothing more or less than the inevitable but slow developing consequence of the Magna Carta. Things were getting into a position in which the right of the secular arm of life could not be any longer denied. It was just one of those peculiar, dramatic inevitables that placed this situation around the selling of papal indulgences. This had really very little to do with the fact. It was that little straw which, added to the others, finally broke the camel's back. But the back had been pretty swayed for a long, long time before that. And the rebellion of Martin Luther was not the rebellion simply of one priest against his own church. It was a rebellion of many minds within the church against certain policies. Therefore, Luther's, one of Luther's nearest and dearest friends, a faithful son of the church and one who remained there, Philip Melanchthon, became also another powerful arm of the Reformation. The Reformation arose not only outside the church but within it, as a result of the gradually rising level of literacy and of general knowledge, and the use, the broad use of the leverage provided by the rationalistic philosophy of Aquinas. It was now possible to think and be orthodox at the same time, a most amazing and incredible state of circumstances, and people were making the most of it. This led to what might be termed the glory of Europe. Here we find the great families vying with each other now in the extravagances of their contributions to culture. We, of course, don't doubt that they also held a few private funds for other uses. But certainly, they were building galleries. They were working in various fields to encourage arts, to bring the people into a greater participation in the crowning glory of a Platonic Athenian commonwealth. And we find even some of the reactionaries talking in the terms that Florence and Rome would be the new great cities that corresponded to Athens and Alexandria in the ancient world. The dream of classical learning had come on with tremendous impact. Now, classical learning also presented a problem, because in this case, in the 14th century, early 15th century, classical learning was a birth out of time. It was no longer in its own world. Actually, the Medici and the Borgias were not very close in their resemblance to Plato and Aristotle. They were a different breed entirely. They had different motives. They were not the simple, homely, underpaid and undernourished philosopher of the Greek school. They were not another barefoot Socrates. They were princes who became dilettantes of learning. Learning was a jewel in their crown. It was not something that changed their lives. It was an ornament. And this resulted in another direction, which was to hit education and to remain even to this day as an unsolved mystery. And that is how to get knowledge out of a man's head and into his life. That is still an unsolved riddle and promises to be so for quite a time to come. But it was getting into the heads of the Renaissance men. And they were also beginning to recognize a very important factor, namely man's power to change the destiny of man. Heaven had been set back a little by the circumstances surrounding Savonarola and Bruno and other scientists within the church, men who had begun to recognize the importance of this thought of Aquinas, that we should begin to explore the universe. And they could not explore the universe long without finding that man was an island in a great sea. And that on this island, men labored with men, struggled with them, fought with them, and died with them. And therefore that man was a maker of destiny as well as an instrument of destiny. And the individuality of man rising up began to change the complexion of the world. The Protestant Reformation had a profound effect upon Christianity. Now, some of this effect was important, some of it was good, and some of it was very bad. And as we look back over the general pattern of things, we have to realize that Protestantism, leading to Puritanism, was not the blessing that we might wish it could have been. Certainly, it did emancipate religion from the tyranny of hierarchy. It made more and more emphasis upon the right of man to personal worship, personal belief, and mystical communion with God according to the dictates of his own conscience. This and this part was very good. But with it came a severance between man and the experience of religion as ritual, as ceremony, as music, as religious pageantry, as spectacle. And man was not quite prepared for this change. For some unknown reason, the gods did not look as godlike in square-toed shoes as they had in robes. It did not carry the same impact. The loss of art, the loss of great music in the church, the loss of the emotional overtones which held man to a certain splendid response within himself. These things began to show serious deficits. There was need to meet these. And Protestantism has still been working with this problem, even today. And for many years, tried to emphasize the lack of need for this, but the need for something which responds or creates response in the emotional, aesthetic nature of man has always been a religious necessity and will always remain one as long as man must feel in order to believe. And he must have a powerful emotional incentive. Thus, in the breaking down of we might say, ceremonialism and art within the church, art itself fell into the doldrums. And as soon as it was no longer guided by religion, art as value began to disappear. Art became hopelessly trivial, as can be shown or examined by going through one of the great palaces of France, such as the Louvre, or the Palais Versailles, or the Palais Royal. In these, we have masses of spindly, gold-legged chairs. We have atrocious copies of French sculpturing and of Greek sculpturing and semi-classical art. We have gewgaws of all kinds, bric-a-brackery to the end of time, and no great, strong art. Then, of course, bereft of its spiritual guide and leadership, art was already to fall into the dilemma of the 19th century, which gave us such things as surrealism, post-impressionism, and caused a critic or judge on an art exhibition, which I had the misfortune to be one of the judges on not too long ago, to say, well, after all, if it means anything, it isn't art. That was what came as the final result, Now this, if it means anything, it isn't art, is only another way of stating a whole group of problems that arose at this time, the time of the Protestant Reformation, which was a revulsion against the glory and grandeur of Florence and the Medici, a revulsion back to simple ways and simple things. But you have the same experience in daily life. I've heard so many people say that they wanted the simple life so badly they could hardly stand it. And when one gets it, he never wants to hear of it again. I know individuals who have said, I want to go off by myself and think. So they go somewhere, they last 12 hours and rush right back to civilization. They can't stand their own company. Now in this rebellion in European culture, men were fighting for something less ornate, more real, more simple, but they were talking with their minds and not their hearts. They were saying things according to conviction, according to pressure, according to prejudice or disillusionment. But when they began to simplify this thing down to the pattern which they themselves declared to be right, they were no better off. Because even when we know the old story of the Pilgrim Fathers that came here for religious liberty, and the first thing they did was to exile into the wilderness some of their own members, it didn't work. It didn't produce a solution. But other factors now were also beginning to conspire. Here we have a Reformation rising, the glory of this period, the Renaissance, then the Reformation, things in Europe bubbling and boiling again, tremendous conflict, a conflict which had gradually reached a new state of security. And I think the keynote of the Renaissance was smug security of achievement. Everybody thought it would last forever. No one questioned for a moment that the golden age had come, that the splendor of things would lead to the eternal perfection of mankind. That is, such perfection as was desirable. No one probably wanted to be very perfect. They simply wanted to be rich and happy. But these things seem to be within reach. The Renaissance had brought visible evidence of a splendid rebirth out of the darkness of the past. Under this splendid situation, the thing happens that always happens. Men began to be careless of the things which they had attained. We know, for example, that in this period, the great city of Venice was the mistress of Europe, one of the most powerful centers in the entire cultural, industrial, economic life of the world. But after having attained this end, Venice began to settle back and had time enough to be unhappy about Venice. The Venetian merchant, having no enemy and no successful rival, had time for private feud. And this was the same general pattern throughout Europe. This glory increased avarice. It made individuals believe firmly that they could afford to neglect their progress and try to take wealth away from each other. It was a day of conspiracies in which great and able persons were poisoned because they were in the way of fools. And this situation weakened inevitably the fabric of Europe and created a new kind of martyr, the kind of martyr we have with Savonarola and Bruno, and to a degree the exiled Dante. We have here now individuals thrown out of society because they dared to attack corruption. It was no longer heresy against God, it was doubting the works of men that got the human being into trouble. And he got into trouble very easily. This was continuing, and a general air of sufficiency continued to prevail until the next eccentric marked the pattern. And that eccentric was the discovery of the New World. And this came in a very critical period, very near the center, just past the middle of this important era. And in the discovery of the New World, the entire psychology of Europe was subjected to a tremendous change. The political circumstances involving the discovery of America are not part of our problem this evening. But I think we may say definitely that for the first time, Europe saw an open door to the front. Europe saw the possibility of expanding beyond the perpetual muddle of Europe itself. Europe had been boiling like a witch's stew for the best part of 14 centuries. It had boiled and reboiled until there was not much left to boil out. Everything was in continual agitation, ancient antagonisms and modern feuds. The struggles between classes, the struggles between groups and levels, all this struggle took place within a small area. The battle was highly confined, and the pressures built up accordingly. Suddenly a great release was found in the navigators and their voyages of exploration. A whole new world was discovered. This new world struck again a great and essential keynote. After the Renaissance, the Reformation brought with it a certain disillusion. Its effect upon arts was so pronounced that for centuries it paralyzed the creative, emotional genius of many countries. They just remained completely unimaginative. They had an orthodoxy more orthodox than anything that had preceded them. But now this orthodoxy was too tight. Everything was closing in. And the great hope was an escape into a new way of life. Nobody believed with any enthusiasm that that new way of life could arise in Europe. The roots of the problems were too deep and too numerous. The hereditary feuds were too irreconcilable. The situation the individual had gotten into was so completely beset with results which he could not control that his only hope was speedy death. The only release from the snarl into which everything had finally fallen was death. So life was not valued very highly in those days. Man prayed almost to die as release from the burden of living. This situation, the new world, created an entirely new group of thinkers. A group of potential leaders, of idealists and visionaries, that had been frustrated and held back by the helplessness of their cause. There was no use mentioning it. It meant nothing. Nothing could be done. And these more brilliant persons, and education was producing more of them, were simply placed in the position of knowing that things should be done, even suspecting what should be done, and being in a position where it was absolutely impossible to do it. Do you recognize the setting? We've got it right now, almost. Where a great many persons realize things that could be and should be done, but the individual is again impotent. The situation has locked him so tightly. He is so completely dominated by group, by collective pressure, that the penalty upon the individual is terrific. In the old days we were speaking of, the penalty for individuality might be death. Today, the penalty for individuality may be bankruptcy. But in both cases, the penalty is as heavy as the flesh can stand, and the individual is blocked. The new world became, to a great many idealists throughout Europe, the great focal point of hope. Here was a vast area, sparsely populated by strange feathered creatures, who we later were called Indians because they had not come from India. These peoples obviously were not developing their natural resources very rapidly, and vast areas of good land awaited those brave enough to hazard the long and dangerous journey in a small boat, dependent upon rains and winds and tides, and would have the audacity to try to establish a way of life in the new world.
Of course, here was a combination of circumstances also, because at that time we had a strong reactionary group moving into the New World. Exploration at that time was very largely under the control of Spain. And Spain at that time was still licking the wounds of the Inquisition. Spain was in a miserable state, and Spain also was tremendously dominated by theology. So, of course, in the real spirit of the occasion, Spain claimed the new hemisphere totally for its own and looked around Europe to see if there was anyone who would say no. And at that moment, there just wasn't a single voice of objection raised. The reason being that Spain was then, in spite of its numerous difficulties, a greatly feared state with supposedly almost an invincible military arm. This situation in Spain, backed as it was by the most of the European Christian world, and unable to move because of the moral prestige of the church, which was thrown to Spain and demanded the allegiance of the rest of Europe to the purposes of Spain, this situation left a sort of miserable spot. But in this miserable moment, when again it looked as though history was going to follow an old course, and that the Inquisition would be set up in the New World, and that the Aborigines would end up speaking Spanish and quoting Latin, another situation broke into the picture. And that little situation was the Spanish Armada. The Spanish Armada, which had as its cause certain misunderstandings between Henry VIII and the Church of Rome, which resulted in the loss of influence and authority and prestige by Cardinal Wolsey and the rise of the Church of England, this situation was rooted definitely in the feud that started with the Magna Carta and ended up with England creating its own church and removing the power of Rome. Rome, which did not like that very well at that time, began to counterplot the situation, and after failing to get Queen Elizabeth of England married to a Spanish prince and make a sort of an infiltration that way, the final showdown came with the Spanish Armada. Now, the Spanish Armada, due to natural circumstances and also to the skill of the English seafaring men, came to a dismal defeat. And with this defeat was the end of Spanish psychological domination of Europe. The defeat of the Armada was a blow from which Spain, as a world power, never recovered. Actually, also, it was the end of Spain's extravagant, fantastic claim in the New World. For immediately after the Armada, England, Holland, and other countries began to colonize and began to extend their spheres of influence into the Western Hemisphere. Out of this situation also now arose greater courage, greater determination to build in the West a world and a way of life that was to be a complete escape mechanism from the European situation. This may in some way be a kind of legitimate heredity, because to a large degree this definite tendency to escape has made perhaps the modern American into the greatest escapist in history. He has this instinct in him, this instinct to get away from authority, to resent discipline, and gradually to attempt at least the management, total management of his own conduct. Under the colonizing plan, we find rising in Europe a group we know as the Utopians. The Utopians were the ones who began to see the possibility of a great world change, and they desired greatly and desperately to make this change come about. They wrote extensively. They created a literature. They fired the imagination of Europe. And out of this firing of the imagination, a double-pronged achievement was attained. One achievement was the rapid development of independent thought and action on the Western Hemisphere. And the second was a rapid liberation of man from the one hemispheric concept of European education. Men not only explored the Western Oceans, but they sailed out between the columns of Galen and Avicenna and dared to demand a free intellectual life in Europe. Ergo, immediately, the doubts, circumstances, conditions which had led up to this period began to flame in Europe, producing the great movements toward liberty. The great movements which were to be climaxed in a series of bloody or bloodless revolutions. Changes that were to break down all of the glories of the Renaissance and to throw the total emphasis of all human culture upon man himself. Now this also had its difficulties, because this emphasis thrown totally upon man began to achieve its end at the expense of man's moral and spiritual life. We find man becoming so important to man that he forgot there was anything else but himself. And from a total state of inferiority, he developed an aggressive state of superiority, in which he began to believe firmly that he was lord of all that he surveyed, that he could do anything that he wanted to do, and that he was all ready to go forth as a full-fledged behaviorist. But he wasn't quite. The climaxing of this situation, the results of all these patterns moving together, meet together in the form of the episodes and situations which introduce the next great cycle, which is still in progress, the cycle which we will have to consider next week as focusing around the critical year of 1800. And we hope to show at that time how distinctly this great cyclic motion again brings about a major crisis met by a new release of spiritual resource. And as we are now in that cycle, perhaps we can learn something of the decline of the resources, why it occurs, and what we may expect, provided there are not too many exceptional breaks in the pattern. The breaks, however, are becoming more regular. The regular patterns are being broken through by innumerable factors. Still, the grand pattern remains, and we are now in the midst of the next great cycle from the one which we are now discussing. And that cycle we will begin to consider next week, beginning with the year 1800 A.D. and dealing on through to our present time and perhaps of something of that time that lies around the corner. Though if we don't get you out of here, you'll be here all night, so I think we'd better stop.